Good evening, AV. My name is Lalo. I am an alcoholic. I have a sobriety date of May 5th, 2011. I want to first start off by thanking my Lord and Savior for the opportunity to share my experience with you guys on another day of sobriety. I want to thank Mark C. for his hospitality. Thank you, Mark. I want to thank Bless Bobby, my sponsor, for connecting me with Mark C. So I've only been up here to the AV a handful of times, and I remember about a year ago, me and Bobby were having the meeting before the meeting, right? Like you always have the meeting before the meeting. So we're in the car driving up here, we're going to a meeting, and we're talking, and he tells me, I used to say that I wouldn't come to AV to drop off a dead dog, right? And then I tell him, I've been to AV to pick up a dead dog. And then I tell him about that story. We start sharing some laughs. And then that conversation ends with him saying, look at us now coming up here for a meeting. And today, look at us now coming up here for a convention. Ain't that something? So I'm very grateful, today. I'm happy. We have a lot of time. And so we're going to go ahead and start with just kind of give you a good picture of what I was like before God intervened. So my first introduction to alcohol, my first introduction to alcoholism was at a very young age, and it came from within my own household. My mother was an immigrant, and she was single, having came to the United States and gave birth to me here in the city of Burbank. And I remember she met a man. He looked respectable, good looking, met him in church. I have this very vivid image of pre-alcohol of this man. And I remember very clearly also him picking up a beer, and after that, I'd never seen him put it down. And so I seen something happen in that man over the course of the years that really sparked my curiosity, because as this man continued to be in our lives, he became very abusive, psychologically, emotionally, physically abusive. And I noticed one thing, that when he was drinking, he was likable, he was tolerable. And I know this today, but I didn't know that then, because today I'm able to articulate, thanks to the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous, I'm able to articulate what, and I understand what is it that he was going through. You see, when he was intoxicated, when he was drinking, he was okay. But when he wasn't, that's when he wasn't. And I remember that I'd rather have him with that drink in his hand than without it. So I was trained from a very young age, when that man gets home, you run to the refrigerator, you grab that beer, you pop it open, you take it to him right away. Because if not, all hell's gonna break loose. And I remember a series of traumatic events in that household. I remember my mom, right, and the beatings and the abuse. I remember just a lot of stuff that happens in many alcoholic homes, right? And very early on, I felt disconnected. I felt disconnected from my mom. I felt like she couldn't protect me. She can't do anything for me. She's choosing this over me. So I felt disconnected from my mom at a very young age. I felt disconnected from my siblings, my half-siblings. They were born from him. and my mom. And so I felt disconnected with them because they were receiving a different treatment than I was. They weren't getting the beatings. They weren't getting the abuse. So I felt disconnected from my family at a very young age. I remember taking my first drink around the age of 9. I wanted to know if that drink would do something for me like it did for that man. I wanted to know if that drink would make me as happy as it made that man. And I remember I drank on Thanksgiving. I got caught, and he told me, you know, he scolded me, and he told me not to be drinking his beer. And the alcoholic that I am, I heard, it's okay to drink beer, just not his beer. And so at that point, you know, I took it for what it was, and I continued my spree, or what was the beginning of it. Around the age of 9, something else happened. I was in Mexico, and I was traveling with my mom. My mom's family's from Mexico. We're from Sinaloa, Mexico. And while I was there, went to my grandma's house, and somebody was like, hey, you want to go visit your dad? And I was like, well, yeah, I think it's about time. I see who this guy really is. And I met my real biological father at the age of 9. We took a long drive. We went to the state prison. And in that prison is where I met my biological father. And I went to that prison, and I remember very vividly, he was on a hammock with two other guys in the shade in its own little caged area. And I observed the whole yard. There was people laboring. Some people were playing soccer. Everybody was doing a lot of different things. However, I remember telling myself, if I ever go to jail, I want to come to this jail. Because he looked very comfortable. He looked calm. He looked like it was just another day. And I remember I connected for the first time with someone. And I told you, I felt really disconnected from my family and in my home. But when I met this man, and he crouched down, and he inquired upon my life, and he said, how are you? And he tried to get to know me. And then he said, how's your mom? And then he says, is she still with that guy? And then I said, yes. And then he says, how's he treating her? And I remember for the first time ever, I opened up about it. We don't talk about this in school. We don't talk about this to anyone, right? Because that's the way that we're raised in Hispanic households, where we don't want the family to be separated. We got enough problems and troubles as is. And so when he crouches down and he says, you know, how's he treating her? And I said, he hits her. And then he says, does he hit you? And I said, yeah. And he says, if he ever touches you again, I'll kill him. And I remember feeling connected for the very first time and feeling loved by somebody for the very first time. To go to any lengths to protect me. I wasn't feeling protected at that time. But when he came into my life, a lot of things changed. And so I came back to the United States. Stuff is still going on. Abuse is still going on. The connection between me and my father is not consistent. So I'm still looking for connection. So I hit the streets. I hit the streets at a very young age. I didn't have curfew. People don't ask me where I'm at. I'm 12 years old. I don't have to go home. And that's how I grew up. I grew up in the city of Pacoima, in the San Fernando Valley. And I remember being out in the street trying to find that connection. And in middle school, a lot of people were making these connections. People were getting into gangs. People were getting into graffiti. People were getting into party crews. I didn't feel connected to any of those groups. But I ran into a group of young kids that I connected with. And the one thing that we had in common was drinking, amongst other things. And so here I am feeling a part of these young men. None of them appear to have fathers either. None of them appear to have curfew. And so we're running around and they're doing things, and they're doing things that I don't necessarily approve of, but I feel alive. I feel the excitement. We're running around town. And I remember being running around that town, being in all kinds of places that I shouldn't have been at such a young age. I've explored tunnels, rooftops, sides of freeways, underpass, every little nit and cranny. I've been there in the dark, in the day. So, and I remember running around with these guys, and my dad's in my life, and I remember now I'm taking trips annually. He gets out of prison. He comes out here. He visits me and takes me out there. And when I'm out there, it's a very different lifestyle. And my dad, he owned some fishing ships, shrimp boats, amongst other businesses. And I remember being at the dock one day in his office, and I'm 12 years old, and he says, "I'm going to tell you one thing." And he says, "Don't steal and don't do drugs." And right away in my head, I already thought, I can't tell this guy anything or about who I am, because I've already been doing that. It's too late. And so I felt disconnected again. And so out there, I'm living this life. I'm introduced to other half-siblings, and I'm living this life that's wild. It's wild. I get some role models. These role models got ostrich and crocodile boots. They got gold-plated guns and cowboy hats and fancy cars and pretty women. And now that's what I want to be when I grow up, right? And it's short-lived, and I come to Pacoima, and I'm in a house with an alcoholic stepdad who likes to take out his frustrations on us. And I want to tell this man, my father, that what's going on. But I'm loyal to my mom. I'm loyal to my siblings. And I said, you know what? Not today. And so that continued. I just tried not to be home as much as possible. And I remember by the time I was in middle school, I was doing what the high school kids were doing. In high school, I was doing what the college kids were doing. I had a fake ID, and it was just, I always had older friends. I had keys to the security gates at my school. I was popular. I was an athlete. I stayed off the hard stuff during football season, and in the off season, I went hard. You know, and I was just, and I had good grades, but I had this instability. I was emotionally unstable. I had a temper. I had this rage inside me, this secret that I couldn't tell. I couldn't tell my biological father. And then I have this secret from Mexico that I can't tell my friends or anyone else. And so now I'm just like constantly in this double life. I'm in this double life. I go out there, I'm rich. I come out here, I'm poor. I go out there, I'm an educated and athlete. I come out here, I'm an alcoholic and a drug addict. And that's the life that I lived. In high school, I remember graduating with honors. Some people try to intervene in my life. Some people try to intervene in my life, pointing out what was already a problem. A lot of things were happening, but the pros still did not outweigh the cons, right? Now, I remember once driving up out here to the AV. I remember just different my memory is spotty of the night, but I remember being with my friend Victor, his brother Dewey. We're in a Civic. It's a two-door Civic. We're in this garage. We're drinking 151 out here in AV. And then the next thing I remember is the sheriff is flashing his flashlight at my face. I'm in the back seat. The door's open. My friend Dewey has his seat all the way up. My head's popped out of the door. I'm vomiting, and the light's coming from behind us. And he says, you okay there, boy? He says, looks like you're throwing up blood. And I said, it's just Kool-Aid. It was something I ate. He looks in the back seat, and he says, nice dog. So I have this dog with me that I didn't know how he got there. But apparently, this dog had parvo, and I thought I was going to save him. So I brought this dead dog from AV down to the valley, and he died on me, sadly, a few days later. So it's funny, not funny, right? But those are the kind of things that were normalized in my life as a teenager. And there's so many examples of that. Police officers waking me up, people waking me up, and things happening, and who are you, and how did I get here? I graduated high school. I was the first in my family to be accepted to a university. I got accepted to Cesonada High School. I had good grades. The things at home were not getting any better. I went 15 years without talking to this man in my house. Very briefly, turn off the lights, leave them on, close the door, lock the door. That's how we spoke. There wasn't like any other kind of conversations happening between me and this man. And at the age of 18, I had to go. I had to leave the house. We weren't getting along. I was getting too brave. I was getting bigger. I was working out a lot. And my anger was way out of control. And there was no way that my mom was going to stop two grown men in the house from fighting. And it was getting pretty bad. And it was also traumatic for my siblings. I realize that today. So I left. Now I'm living at my aunt's house. I'm in the garage. I'm this 18-year-old, and I got this back house. No supervision whatsoever. Think I got it all figured out. I'm going to do this. I'm going to do that. How are you going to do it? Well, dad's going to help me start a business. My dad's going to help me do this. My dad's going to help me do that. That's the perspective that I had. I thought I had this ace in my pocket, the backup plan. He was my way out. I looked at him like, that's how I'm going to get out of Pacoima. That's how I'm going to get out. And the disease extends further than just biologically, right? It extends further than just the family. It extends further than just socially, right? This disease permeates into different facets of life. And this disease can kill you even when you're not consuming it. You see, the things that my father was engaged in are part of this disease. The things that he was doing are part of this big picture that today we're fighting against, this epidemic. And so, life's institutions and death. Right, so it says, jails, institutions, and death. I met him in a jail. Never made it to an institution. But he died when I was 19. And they killed him in a very savage way. They killed him along with my grandfather. They killed him with a couple. Everybody who was in that car was massacred. And that was a very traumatic experience for me. And I felt like I was robbed. And I felt like I was, like somebody had pulled my ACE, my meal ticket out of Pacoima, my only chance of living a decent life, I thought. Right? That's how close-minded I was. And mind you, when I'm at this age, I'm very, very egotistical. I'm cocky, I'm arrogant, right? All-star football player, graduate, living by himself. You can't tell me anything. When I think about my younger self, it annoys me. And so that experience, I think I just let it out after that. I just became really angry. I started projecting. Started projecting the same anger that was imposed upon me, and I started projecting it out onto the world. I started taking, I stopped attending college. I couldn't manage it. My life became unmanageable. So I stopped going to college, and I started engaging in very high-risk behavior. I'm crossing people over the border. I'm selling things that I shouldn't be selling. I'm doing things that I shouldn't be doing. The whole time, I'm just like self-reliant. I'm my own meal ticket. You're not going to help me. I don't need your help. So by this time, the peers that I had connected with had already been affected by this disease. You see, one of the greatest symptoms of this disease is disconnection. What we're going to be talking about today is disconnection. And alcoholism, substance abuse, whatever, disconnects you. And disconnected me from myself, disconnected me from my family, disconnected me from my peers, disconnected me from God. You see, I had a God of my understanding when I was 12, but I didn't know how to hang on to it. I remember going to little spiritual retreats and feeling good when I came back, but it was only a matter of hours before I was out and running again. I didn't know how to stay connected to anyone or anything. So life began to happen, and a series of traumatic events continued to happen. And it's really easy to just kind of blame the next issue, the next hardship, the next separation, the next death, right? The next whatever. It's really easy to blame the next whatever. As long as we just to rationalize that next drink, just to rationalize that next hit. And so that's what I did. I rationalized. I endured a series of traumatic events, right? My son was, I was separated from my son. My brother died in the same gruesome manner as my dad. He was 6 months younger than me. We're 25. And now, from my 20s, are a complete blur. I was transforming into this person that later I would not recognize. School was no longer a thing. I'm now no longer at my aunt's house. I'm a klepto. I'm thieving. I'm robbing. I'm stealing. Every single day of my life. Didn't have a job for about 10 years. I don't want to be employed. I don't care about anything. I don't care about you. I don't care about me. I don't care about anything. I just want to do what I'm doing because I just want to feel okay right now. That's it. I just want to feel okay right now. Because right now is all I got. I don't want to think about the future because I spent all my childhood thinking about the future and it didn't turn out the way that it was, that I thought it was supposed to. So I'm not thinking about the future. I'm thinking about right now, and I want to feel good right now. My tolerance is crazy. My tolerance is crazy. I mean, I'm doing a lot more than just drinking. I'm like a garbage can. Unsatiable. And so I remember thinking that I was so smart because I had been to college, and I'm always thinking about, you know what? What's that one lick that's going to, how do I get more by doing less? And I'm so, everything that you can think of selling, I've sold it. I've tried to find some kind of loophole. I've tried to find some kind of like something. Something that was different. Something that was just creative, crafty, I don't know. So I always had these wonderful ideas. And I remember one of these ideas came to me, and I thought it was the best thing I had ever discovered. So this old man, who had probably been in the streets way longer than I have, he's like a mentor in the streets, you know. He has a lot of street cred, and he's just one of those old men you don't mess with, and everyone knows, and he's like very smart, very, very smart. Mechanic, probably could have been an engineer, can build stuff, take them apart, all kinds of stuff. Cooks stuff. And I'm thinking, oh, man, this guy knows a lot of things. So he introduces me and my buddy to cutting catalytic converters, right? And I remember the first one, I remember my car was broken down and I needed some parts. There was a broken down car just like my car. We went and to try to get parts from this car. In a legit way, we went up and we knocked on the door. We said, hey, this car's been here forever. Can I have it? The lady's like, yeah, you can. If you can tow it, you can have it. And he's like, forget the car, dude. Just get that part right there. Right? And I said, for what? He says, easy money. I said, okay. Took it off, whatever. And then we went and we cashed in. And I was like, wow, that was pretty easy money. And I remember me and my buddy, Robert, God bless his heart. We went and we tried to do this on our own. And we have no idea what we're doing. Takes me a week to take the first one off. Takes me a week. Really does. How did I not get caught on that same vehicle in an apartment complex going at it every day with a different tool for a whole week? I don't know. I just went back to that car and he said, that didn't work. Let's try again tomorrow. Let's try again tomorrow. Let's try again tomorrow. And we went back and we finally took that thing off. And it was the hardest thing that we ever had to do. And I was like, this doesn't feel like easy money. But I'm out of self. You know, I'm out of self. That's all I care about. I don't want to think about my son. I don't want to think about how much of a dirtbag I am. I don't want to think about my mom getting her butt kicked. I don't want to think about the college that I just messed up. I don't want to think about my dad. I don't want to think about my siblings. I don't want to think about none of that. I just want to have some fun. I just want to get out of self. So finally, I do my homework on these things, and I'm just like, I'm going to figure this out. And I tried every single tool out there, and I got it down to a science. And I know exactly what tool I need and what kind, what brand. I know what blade, how much power. I know everything that I need to remove one of these things in 30 seconds. And so now we got this thing figured out. They're coming off in 30 seconds. We got this bright idea. Let's get a crew together. We got a couple more guys. Now we got two guys jumping off the car, one guy driving, and we're going through these neighborhoods. I'm sorry if this has happened to your car. And we're going through these neighborhoods, and just picture stopping at every red car you see, just like that. Just like, we'll go by colors, right? But we were stopping on certain cars. But just picture going down the street, and every red car you see, you just stop next to it. And that was what we were doing. And we would stop next to this car, we'd jump out, and in 30 seconds, we're jumping back in with this clunk piece of metal that we're about to go cash in. And these things are making a lot of noise, a lot of noise. We're cutting these things with sawzaws, and it's leaving a trail. People are coming out, they don't see us. It's coming out on the news. We're thinking we're ahead of the game. They still have, like, they're never going to catch us. But we're leaving a big trail, big trail. Long story short, I did get caught. I was one of the first people to get caught doing that, and during that specific period. And I remember the cops didn't even know what it was or what I was doing. There's, defacing private property. I said, I'll take it. Misdemeanor. Right? It's a felony grand theft now. And I'm in jail, and I'm just like, man. I get my first breath of sobriety. Very short-lived. Very short-lived. Only did a couple months there. And I remember this one instance where they're just like, okay, it's time for you to go. And I was not ready to go. I felt for the first time like I was on a break. Like I had a breather of fresh air. My first sober breath in years. And I get out, and the insanity. Same day I got out. Get caught again. And go back in. And I remember reaching out to a higher power that I really manipulated, right? So I had this idea that the relationship that I had with my higher power was crazy, right? I used to think that if I stole from you, that you must have done something to piss God off. I used to think, like, I'll do anything to rationalize my behavior, like, oh, you were in the wrong, right? And so that's the only way that I could hold on to my God, because I had already been carrying so much guilt, so much shame, that the only way I'm going to hold on to God is with his permission. The only way that I'm going to be able to continue doing any wrong is with his permission. And so if that's what it takes for me to get through another day, that's what I'm going to do. I'm a survivor. So I continued this journey, cutting these things, and then I figured out a different way, and I said, now I'm in silent mode, and I'm by myself. So now I'm like a ninja, I think, right? And I said, the average human being is dumb for going to work. I said, at 3 o'clock in the morning, I already have my next victim. I'm cutting two of these things off of one vehicle. I'm cashing in on $400, and I'm done for the day. I'm making anywhere from $200 to $400 a day. It's taking me a few minutes, and I think that I got something over on the average human being. I think I have this secret come up. But I cannot hold on to any of the money if my life depended on it. I couldn't, because I would get the hotel, I'd get what I needed, and then I'd get some food, and it was gone. And I knew that I needed to go to work the next morning. And I did that for many, many years. Rain or shine, daylight or midnight, car dealers, apartments, boulevards, freeways, store parking lots, church parking lots, during Mass. Yeah. It was just like no conscience. And my son began to come in and visit me from Arizona. And he'd always have this, I don't know, God has this funny way of bringing him on the days that I just didn't have anything. Never bring him on the day that I was that I was holding some money. He'd never bring him on a day that I was feeling on top of the world. He would always bring him on a day that I was hurting. And I hated when he would see me like that. And I would try to hold up my head up high, and I would see this kid in his face. And then when he would leave, it would just break me. It would hurt me. And I knew that I wanted something different, but I didn't know what or where to find it. You see, in my culture, and I didn't know anyone who was sober. I didn't know anything about AA. I didn't know anything about rehab. Those words weren't even in my vocabulary. I've never seen a sober person. I didn't know what that was. I normalized the life that I was living. But I wanted something to change. I'm 31 years old, and I remember he comes back one more time, or actually he's probably living in Los Angeles now. His mom's giving me a hard time. You're such a dirtbag. He needs clothes. He needs a backpack. Why don't you ever do anything for him? And I had so many tricks up my sleeve. I was a klepto, and I would not go a day without having what I needed, because it's just, I had been doing it for so long. And it wasn't about money for me. Sometimes it was just to see if I could pull it off. And I would do, sometimes I would do these elaborate schemes and that I would be very proud of. And sometimes I would just do these petty, petty moves, like steal a deodorant with $200 in your pocket and get caught. And he came one day and she was giving me a hard time. I said, I know what I'm going to do. I got this. I do it all the time. Whenever I need clothes, I do it. And I went and I did this thing that I do at a store. And I'm walking out, and the guy stops me. And he says, I need to talk to you. He pulls us into the detainment room. And he's like, I don't know how you did it, but I know you did something wrong, and I'm going to prove it. I said, well, let me know when you prove it, because right now I got a receipt. And until you figure out how I did what I did, whatever it is that you're talking about, then, you know, let me know. And he's there. He's calling the cops. I said, I'm busted. I know I am. My kid's looking at me like for the first time. I think he had his doubts that I was a dirtbag, that he heard I was, probably from his mom. But I felt like in my head, when I would present myself to him in a very natural way, I felt like he had his doubts of what he was hearing, right? Because we tend to look at people in the best light. I mean, our children especially do. And so I felt like that's the way he looked at me. But that day, his affect changed, and he looked at me for what I was. I was a dirtbag. I was not his dad. I had to call his real dad, his stepdad. I had to call his stepdad to come pick him up because I thought I was going to jail. I had to suck up my pride and call this dude and said, hey, I think I'm going to go to jail. I think you need to come pick him up. For whatever reason, I remember praying in that room, and he says, you think God is going to take you out of here? And he says, I remember him mocking me, the detective or the store police. He wasn't even a police, he was the store guy. And he's mocking me, telling me, you think your God's going to get you out of here? And I remember, and I said, you know what? My God's bigger than your God. And that day, for whatever reason, because he's not the police, and I always thought I was really smart and I knew a lot of things, and so I knew he had 3 hours, that I had 3 hours before they have to let me go. 3 hours came, cops never came. It must have been a busy day in the San Fernando Valley. And I walked home, and that was like the longest walk that I have ever had. And I remember bawling my eyes out because my God had proven himself to me at that very moment, like he has multiple times. But once again, he had proven himself to me. And for that first time, I surrendered and I was like, oh, I needed something different. And I cried and I bawled my eyes out and I walked over and I told my son and I lied to him in his face and I told you, you see, I told you I was going to see you at home. They didn't know what they were talking about. And I felt like I could hold my head up high for just a little bit longer. But I had this feeling, this nervous feeling, not the kind of nervous feeling I had before I spoke today. It was like this nervous feeling like I'm going to go to jail kind of feeling. Like they're going to come knocking on my door later because enough's enough. I know that all of my peers have already caught stretches. All of my peers were already doing time. All of my peers had already met their match or have already encountered these hardships, that legal hardships that I had yet to encounter. I was suffering hardships, financial hardships. I played off. I was homeless for a bit. I played it off really well because I'm a survivor, and so I'm never going to let you see when I'm hurting. I'm never going to let you see when I need something. I'm never going to let you see what's really going on because I'm disconnected. I don't even know what's really going on. Even if I wouldn't even be able to explain it if you asked me, how do you feel? What is that? What are feelings? At this point, that's how disconnected from myself I was and from everyone else. God puts this girl in my life who tells me about a treatment center and tells me how to get there. I go to this treatment center. I go to this treatment center, and at this treatment center, for the first time, I'm introduced to the concept of recovery. Actually, the concept of treatment. Treatment is not recovery. Let's clear that up. Treatment is not recovery. Recovery is what you do outside of treatment. Relapse is not a part of recovery. It's a part of addiction. Sobriety is a part of recovery. I don't know how that got mixed up somewhere along the way, but I've heard that. And I see a lot of people just like me. I don't know nothing about them, but I could feel it, that something between them and myself is connecting us. I get to this treatment center, and this is a county facility. There's 100 people there with different personalities. I don't know any of them, but I feel connected to these people. Today I know it's having shared in a common peril. That's why I was connected with them. And I see this guy. And I go to these meetings, and now they're having meetings inside, and I'm hearing these messages. I remember this guy. He had a patch in his eye, and he was aggressive, and then he told this story, and he caught my attention. And I said, if this can work for him, maybe this can work for me. And I started to really pay attention to the people that were coming in there and sharing the message and about how their life changed. They tell me to get a sponsor, and so I see this guy, and I think he's got the answer. And he's got the answer because he's sitting at the treatment center and he's got all these girls around him. And I said, oh, yeah, that guy's got an answer. I don't know what he's doing, but he's doing it right. I go up and I talk to him. Hey, you know, what's this big book stuff? And he says, oh, you know, this is the book of Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, and we're doing step work. I said, oh. And I had already heard a few things like, the men stick with the men, the women stick with the women. It turned out this guy was gay, sponsoring a bunch of women, right? And I said, oh, okay. And so, but I'm still intrigued by what's going on. And gradually, I said, well, can I listen? And this guy, Cameron, who was my first sponsor, he saved my life. A person that I least thought could tell me about anything. I said, you different culture, right? He's black. Different sexual identity, he's gay. What are you going to tell me about anything? But I knew that I had to set aside everything that I thought that I knew. I knew that everything that I thought that I knew up to that point was incorrect. And he did something for me that day. You see, what I'm doing today is like, it's like having a bucket of water and splashing it on top of a bunch of empty bottles, hoping that something gets in. But he did something different for me. He grabbed me, an empty bottle, brought it up to the bucket, submerged it, and filled me up to the top. That's the difference between speaking and sponsorship. Right? I hope one of you guys gets the message today. One of you. But what he did that day, he filled me up to the top, and my life changed. And I knew that whatever it was that I was going to embark on, I had to go full on and full force. And I remember I stayed at that treatment center for 7 months because I had a lifelong addiction. I was 31 years old, and I had something that had started at the age of 9, and I had already lost everything. And so I didn't have any other choice but to try this program of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I did. And it changed my life. I got out of there and I did exactly what you guys told me to do. I started working with others. And I started going to any lengths. I was so in debt with the IRS, with restitution, with credit debt. I owed everybody. I didn't have a driver's license. So I took the bus. For the first couple of years of my sobriety, I lived in a sober living for the first couple of years of my sobriety. I started working, started going to school. And I went back to school only because I needed to occupy this brain of mine that was trying to take me out all the time. And when I went to school, I went with this curiosity of trying to figure out what had happened to me. Because I knew something happened to me and I couldn't explain it. And so I set out and I took addiction studies and I studied about it. And then eventually I embarked in this clinical career. I got hired by the same treatment center that took me in. They hired me at about, I don't know, 3 years of sobriety. Finally off of probation. Finally paid the IRS. Finally got out of debt. Meanwhile, the relationship with my son is getting better. He visited me at the treatment center. He says, good job, Dad. I said, man, I feel like my mom looks at my hands. She says, oh, my God. She starts crying. She said, I ain't never seen your hands this clean. I said, yeah, you know. It was real, you know. My hands were all beat up, just doing things. And to fast forward, recovery has been so, so good to me. It taught me to grow up all over again. It introduced me to people who taught me how to be a dad, who taught me how to be a student, who taught me how to be an employee, who taught me how to be a man. It introduced me to people who taught me how to pay bills. It introduced me to people who taught me how to do everything that I know how to do today. I seen one of you guys do it. Kept going to school, and I finally made it back to that university that had kicked me out because of my life had gotten manageable. My mom's super proud of me. She leaves. She finally gets away from that toxic relationship. And I remember by this time, I had already, so I graduated with a bachelor's in psychology from the same school that I got kicked out from, and it was hard to get back in, but God saw fit. And I had already sold all of my jewelry, and I had already sold everything that I had possessed. And I remember as an amends to myself, I got me this ring. And inside of it, it says one day at a time. And I got to have these experiences. And somewhere down the line, something happened. My son's mom, who also suffered from this disease. And God saw fit for me to take full custody of that boy. Now I'm like, I'm his coach, I'm his dad, I'm going to his football games, I'm a provider, I'm a productive member of society, I'm off probation, I'm working in treatment, I'm doing this thing called recovery. Life gets good, it gets busy. And I remember having this experience where recovery starts to take the back burner. Recovery starts, somebody calls it a slip, right? Sobriety losing its priority. But I feel that I'm getting disconnected, right? So by this time, I'm connected. I'm connected to this power greater than myself. I'm connected to the fellowship, I'm connected to my family. I'm not suffering from the disconnection that I had experienced my whole life. I'm thriving, everything's wonderful. And so I start drifting away from the program a little bit, and I start focusing too much on my physical. I feel good internally, and I want to look good externally. I start obsessing about exercise and money, and now I'm just thinking about materialistic and superficial things. But I had enough foundation to understand where this was leading. God had put people in my way, in my path, that had relapsed as a reminder or as a warning. You're next. And I said, no, that's not going to be me. And I knew exactly what I needed to do. Prioritize recovery over everything. Over everything. Over the life, over my family, over my work, over my school, everything. Recovery for me is synonymous with God. He needs to be my priority. All the time. I'm able to continue on this wonderful path, this wonderful journey. I have a huge friend group, huge friend, a huge sober network of friends. Playing sober softball, I'm getting involved, I'm doing all kinds of things, we're having sober parties, we're going to conventions, we're doing it all. Life's wonderful. And I continue going to school. And if you're waiting for the story to fall off, it doesn't. This is life's just happening, right? Life's great. It's just I'm trying to figure out if I'm leaving anything out. But what I'm trying to say is, this is God working in my life. This is not self-reliance anymore. This is not anything of my own doing. My ability to graduate, my ability to be a father, my ability to be a coach, my ability to be a clinician. It's God seeing who sees me fit. It is God working in my life. It is me getting out of his way. Because it was not my idea. It was not my idea. I learned to put my bright ideas to the side. And it's okay to have these ideas. I just don't have to act on them today. I'm no longer this dysregulated young adult. I'm very composed, calm individual for the most part. And I keep going to school. I get a master's degree in social work. I get cool jobs, work with kids in the jails, and I get to be this person that I needed when I was a kid. I needed a guy like me in my life. I needed a guy like me to tell me where I was going. And sometimes I would run into these kids that remind me of me, and man, they would get on my nerves because he was arrogant, cocky, and had it all figured out. And he's like, man, that was me. This kid reminds me of me. And so I'm doing all this great work. On my graduation day this last year, recovery, just like alcoholism is a family disease, recovery is a family solution. It's not an individual solution. It's a family. It's an antidote, right? And when I say recovery, I mean it all. I mean the unity service, the recovery. I mean the meetings, the commitments, the sponsorship, all of it, right? It's the antidote. So my family's healing. We're giving hugs. We're saying I love you. I feel connected to my family, right? My mom feels redeemed. My mom feels like the mother that she always wanted to be to me. And I feel like the son that I always wanted to be with her, to her. No longer getting her car impounded in TJ. I'm no longer making her walk through hot summers because I stole her car, right? I'm no longer scaring my siblings because of my behavior. They feel safe with me. They look up to me. My sister, super competitive. She's like, I'm not about to let this crackhead graduate before me. She went ahead and she got her master's degree. We graduated on the same day from different school. And my little sister, she's the second oldest, so she got to witness a lot of the abuse firsthand, not to herself personally, but it was just as traumatic for her to watch it. And I'm realizing that, so on her graduation day, it's my graduation day. I had already experienced a couple graduations back to back, right? I graduated my associates, graduated my bachelor's. Mom's super happy. It's like, but on that day, I knew that mom was going to have to make a decision. Mom was going to either have to go to my graduation or she's going to have to go to my sister's graduation. And then, you know, I know my mom loves me more. And I have this conversation with my sister, and she's like, what are we going to do? I said, well, she needs to go to your graduation. She's like, don't you want her to go to your graduation? I said, no, I don't. you know, I said, that other graduation, that was for her. This one's for me. I didn't do this one for her. This, I just kept going for me. But I have enough insight through the work of Alcoholics Anonymous, coupled with a little bit of education, to understand that I've been robbing my sister from a spotlight for a long, long time. My mom cannot be a mom to this girl because she's too busy wondering where this boy is at who hasn't been home in 3 days. She don't got time to be a mother to this daughter. She don't got time to be a mother to any of those kids. She's stressed beyond her mind, wondering what I'm doing, where I'm at. And I said, and in recovery, and I also know, have enough insight to understand how our psyche kind of works. I know a lot of my mom suffers a lot of guilt. She's expressed it, and I know she suffers a lot of guilt. And so it's not that my mom loves me more that she would go to my graduation. It's just that she would go because she just feels guilty for a lot of the things that I've been through. But we've cleared that up, that it's not her fault. And I'm really grateful for everything that she's ever done for me. I did not need another enabler in my life. I didn't. So we go to my sister's graduation. In the morning, I said, okay, and I'll just, if I run a little late, I'll go to mine. And we go to this graduation. My stepdad is sitting a couple rows ahead in his alcoholism. And you know how I can tell he's sitting in his alcoholism? Because the symptom of disconnection is present. He's sitting by himself. He's sitting by himself with nobody in his life except three empty rows of seats of people who are supposed to join him who didn't, to see his daughter graduate. And for a first time in a long time, I see my mom, and she has that look on her face. Like this nervous look on her face, like she doesn't know what's gonna happen. She just wants to crawl into this shell. She just wants to hide. I feel like she just feels so uncomfortable because there he is. Here I am. We haven't seen each other in 11 years. She doesn't know what's going to happen. But the moment that I have the opportunity, I walk up to him. I shake his hand. And all that past trauma, all that past hurt, all that past experience gets diluted. Gets diluted. Doesn't go away, it just gets diluted. And I look at my mom and she just feels so relieved, and what she sees is recovery in action. Forgiveness in action. And I connect with this guy, having shared in a common peril. I know his language now. I'm 42 years old. I know exactly what you're suffering from. I've been disconnected. I've been through everything that you have been through. I know exactly what you need. He knows that. He wants it. He says, I heard you're graduating too. Congratulations. If you need anything, let me know. He sees my son. He says, man, I haven't seen you in forever. Look at you. Gives him a hug. And that's it. Walk away. But my whole family just witnessed something very magical happen that they've never seen in their whole life. The longest conversation they've ever seen us carry. You see, if I went to, in one of my classes, this neurosurgeon, he gave his whole speech on trauma, and it was very wonderfully executed. And he gives this example, and he talks about if this water bottle was full of poison, it would be pretty hard to remove the poison from it. And he says, but if you take it and you drop it into a lake, does that mean the whole lake is poison? It's like, no. Does that mean that the poison is gone? No. It's just not, it just loses its power. And right away I thought, that's AA. That's AA. Where I got to bring my trauma, submerge it into this solution that we have, and this and my trauma is still there, but it has no power over me today. It's been diluted. It's been diluted. If you're new here today, bring it to us. Bring us your hurt. Bring us your experience, your pain, your traumas, your grief, your separation, your disconnection. Bring it to us. Share it with us. We've shared in that. We've experienced that. We'll help you dilute it. And maybe you too can help the next person. That's all it really is about. Just one alcoholic helping another. That's all I am today. That's what I am first. It's not all I am. That's what I am first. Then I'm a lot of other things. And it's only because of the God in my life that has allowed me to be these things. And I never want to forget that. I want to say thank you once again to everybody who's here today. I want to say thank you for just participating in my recovery. I want to say thank you to my friends from the San Fernando Valley who came out to support me. You guys are the real ones. Thank you. And this was my first convention ever speaking. I'm not a circuit speaker. I'm not just a regular alcoholic trying to share his experience. That was the longest share I've ever given in my life. But it worked out.
That's right.
And I just want to say thank you, AV, and I hope that you have a wonderful evening.
Right on.